welcome to this hearing on current and future wholesale electricity markets. Let me be the first to thank our witnesses today for making the effort to be with us on this important subject. My remarks are not going to be long because I'd rather hear from our witnesses than to hear myself talk. I do want to remind our audience that the subject today is the wholesale electricity market, not the retail electricity market. We, meaning the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, does not have direct jurisdiction over wholesale electric prices. But we do have an obligation to inform ourselves of what is happening in that market. And if we believe that something is amiss, we have an obligation to speak to our counterparts on the federal level, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and to the Congress if necessary. And therefore, we have asked these experts to testify today to help us understand the wholesale electric marketplace. The presiding administrative law judge today is Louis Couturis, and I'm going to ask him to begin the hearing formally. And yes. Would you please do so, Judge?
Thank you. Yes, remove me. Last week I was over there. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I have a few very simple ground rules to go over with you. First of all, if you've got a cell phone in your pocket or your purse, please turn it off or to at least silent. Second, for the benefit of the speakers today, I will be have that magic light machine up there. It is set for a 15-minute presentation. I will give you a reminder at about 1 minute to go. It will also flash yellow at about 30 seconds to go. And please don't take us into the red light zone. All right? Speakers have all brought copies of their testimony, which I think are not only available in paper form somewhere in this room, I suspect in the table on the far side to my right and your left, but they should also be available electronically on the website. So if there, by any chance, we've run out of paper copies, you can always come to the commission website. And my last request is that you keep in mind that our commissioners are bound by the ex parte rules, so we are not able to discuss cases that are being actively litigated at this time. Other than that, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that I have the honor of introducing Ms. Kelly, who is the Vice President of the American Public Power Association. Ms. Kelly, would you come up to the microphone, please? Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Ms. Kelly.
Thank you.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Can everybody hear me? Is this all right? Okay. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to appear here today on behalf of APPA. I will speak directly into the mic. Maybe that will be of some assistance, which means I'll have to put my presentation out here. We represent more than 1,000 publicly owned electric utilities in 49 different states. Public power systems serve over 45 million consumers, providing over 15% of the kilowatt hours sold in the United States. There are 35 municipally owned systems in Pennsylvania, and they serve 83,000 customers here. Our members are not for profit. They have retained the legal obligation to serve. We never did not do retail access. Since they're owned by the customers they serve, they passed all their costs and savings on directly to their consumers. We own approximately 10% of the nation's electric generating capacity, but we have to purchase nearly 70% of our power nationwide on the open wholesale market. Therefore, we have a very strong interest in a well-functioning wholesale market, and since we try to provide power at the lowest reasonable cost consistent with environmental stewardship and reliability, we have a strong interest in making sure those markets work. However, APPA members in RTO regions with FERC-regulated wholesale power markets are experiencing real difficulties obtaining reasonably priced and reliable wholesale power supplies. For example, wholesale power costs for the municipal utilities in New Jersey doubled between 1992 and 2007, and then doubled again in 2008. Public power systems in Maine have seen significant increases. We had one system whose cost tripled. We have other power systems that are taking what we call offensive action to reduce our reliance on RTO wholesale markets. One of those is American Municipal Power Ohio, or AMP Ohio. It's a joint action agency that provides wholesale power to 122 public power systems in Ohio and five other states, and that includes 26 power systems in Pennsylvania. AMP Ohio is undertaking a program to build and own its own generation and to undertake demand response for its member utilities. Its goal is to try and insulate its members from the RTO wholesale markets and the price volatility that it is now experiencing there. Now, I know the rate caps that were negotiated as part of the transition to retail access in Pennsylvania have largely sheltered your retail customers so far from price increases and volatility in RTO-run markets. But as you know better than I, those rate caps are expiring, and then you will then be in the situation that our members in RTO regions are in, which is directly exposed to the volatility in RTO wholesale markets. One measure of the success of restructured retail and wholesale markets is whether, quote, deregulation has reduced prices. While there's no doubt true that electricity and other energy prices are rising all across the country, we don't dispute that. But the chart at page 3 of my prepared testimony shows that retail electric rates are higher in states with deregulated markets. The rate disparity is increasing, and even when fuel costs are taken into account, the gap continues to widen. We believe that increased federal oversight of RTO-run wholesale power markets is needed for state regulators to be able to protect their retail consumers and for public power systems to serve their retail customers, and I will now explain why we think this. In response to the growing problems that APPA members had in RTO regions, we launched our so-called Electric Market Reform Initiative, what we call EMRI, in March of 2006. We first commissioned a series of studies of the wholesale market, and I discuss a number of them in my testimony. They're all available on our website. Based on the studies, APPA concluded that RTO-run markets are not yielding just and reasonable rates, as the Federal Power Act would require. We've therefore started an advocacy effort to deal with these problems and to communicate the need for changes to key decision makers, both federal and state. We're also developing proposals to attempt to reform these markets. I want to emphasize here that we are not RTO haters. We actually believe that RTOs provide real benefits to both retail and wholesale markets. They provide independent and non-discriminatory transmission service. They provide regional non-pancaked transmission rates. They provide regional collaborative transmission planning. We think those are all good things. We supported the formation of ISOs, such as PJM and MISO, for that very reason. But over time, FERC's policy emphasis has turned from these kind of core transmission functions to complex market operations, and those have overshadowed the more basic and beneficial functions. There are very substantial RTO resources now dedicated to overseeing and running these markets, and we think several features of the market are problematic. The first is the single clearing price auction. It's really hard in 15 minutes to go into all these, so I'm just going to be giving you a true, you know, tiny fingernail sketch. Under the single clearing price auction, an RTO takes all offers by generators to sell in the short-term markets for an upcoming time interval and stacks them all in ascending price orders. It stops with the last offer that's needed to meet demand in that hour. But all these generators hold FERC-granted market-based rate authority, and so their bids do not need to reflect their cost, as was traditional under past regulation. The only limits on their offers are the market rules set by the RTO and any mitigation imposed by the market monitor. All sellers whose offers are accepted in that time interval get paid the price paid to the last entity, the so-called clearing price. As a result, lower cost resources are often paid prices far in excess of their own costs and the marginal cost of production of the highest generator in the price interval. This is intended to send so-called price signals to generators about the value of generation to customers and is supposed to induce new entry. But the actual impact of this mechanism is questionable. One of the studies that we commissioned and that I discuss in my testimony analyzed offer data from generators in PJM and ISO New England, and it found that offers from the same unit in the same month could vary by as much as $100 a megawatt hour. It's hard to say that that is all cost-based, those differentials, within the course of 1 month. They concluded that from this data and much else like it, that the fact that market power was present was fairly compelling. The second feature is locational marginal pricing. Again, a very difficult concept that's very hard to explain. Basically, when there's what they call transmission congestion on the grid, the prices separate into a series of submarkets, and so you have clearing prices in this whole series of submarkets. This was intended to send a price signal as to where on the grid new transmission and new generation should be located. But again, there's no evidence from the studies that we've done that this has actually occurred. The third feature that's bothered us is the participation of financial players in the market. Hedge funds, investment banks, and other financial entities have been participating in RTO markets through the auctions, both for power supply and for the so-called financial transmission rights. They participate solely in the hope of extracting dollars. They are not there to hedge transactions. The rationale for allowing this is that they add liquidity. We're concerned, however, that these profits are coming from the pockets of retail customers, and we'd like to see more kind of research and study done on that. But worse yet, consumers can end up footing the bill for such players even when they make the wrong bets. And the most spectacular example of this is covered in my testimony. It's the so-called tower company's complaint that PJM has filed against a group of hedge funds from New York City. PJM is seeking restitution and other remedies from these companies to their credit. But in April of 2008, FERC issued an order holding that complaint in abeyance while its own staff did an investigation. And I checked the docket sheet Monday or Tuesday when I was writing this testimony. There's been no official public action in that case since then. Unless the tower companies are required to disgorge money, other PJM customers and ultimately retail consumers theoretically are going to have to make up this shortfall. And we think that's a grossly unjust result. The fourth design feature is locational capacity markets. I'm going to just touch on this very lightly because your commission knows more about this than I do. PJM's new locational capacity market is called the reliability pricing model, and it's produced drastically increasing capacity costs in PJM. We commissioned a study because our members in the PJM region said, please, you know, you got to help us. So we produced a study. That in turn has eventually led to a complaint that has been filed by a number of entities, including your commission against FERC, so I'm not going to discuss that anymore. Finally, while it's not technically a design feature, APPA has long been disturbed by the difficulty in obtaining data about these markets to analyze price formation. Reams of information are available on RTO websites, but some of the highly relevant data is not. For example, we did a study again to delve into this issue, and the study found that RTOs publish large amounts of data, but they keep the most crucial information, generator offer data and generator cost data, confidential. The generator offer data is not released until a few months after the time, and even then the identities of the bidders are masked. Our study recommended that this be done on a next day basis with all full information provided. The failure to disclose this data so that everybody knows what's happening makes it harder to police these very complex markets. The full brunt, in effect, falls on the market monitors in the first instance and FERC in the final analysis to make sure that these markets are operating smoothly. One recent example of the drawbacks to this is the settlement that was negotiated between Edison Mission, which is a generator in PJM, and FERC staff regarding Edison Mission's use of the so-called high offer strategy. I explain this in my testimony. It's too difficult to go into in 15 minutes. Suffice it to say that Edison Mission agreed to pay a $7 million penalty, but that penalty was not for the use of the high offer strategy. Instead, that was for a failure to be candid with FERC staff about its use of that strategy. It didn't require any disgorgement of refunds in the settlement, and it never indicated whether this pricing strategy violated the PJM tariff. None of us knew that this was going on until the commission issued the order approving this settlement. And a large group of PJM customers, state commissions, and other interested customers, including both your commission and APPA, then intervened in this case to seek clarification of the scope of the settlement. But in an order issued on October the 7th, FERC has flatly denied our intervention. They've also said that the PJM customers and state commissions can't really pursue Edison Mission in any other forum because their jurisdiction is exclusive. We find all this extremely troubling. Only the RTO market monitoring unit and staff have full access to the confidential data needed to examine what's going on in these markets. Yet it says only in the most extraordinary circumstances will allow third parties to intervene to comment on enforcement settlements, even though we don't have any notice that this is going on till, in effect, it's all over. And then they claim they are the only forum in which these claims can be considered. Now, I have to tell you, there's been a lot of growing frustration on load-side interests in Washington about the operation of these markets, and FERC opened a rulemaking proceeding in 2007 to consider this. They had a series of technical conferences, and APPA, among others, was very hopeful that this would be a vehicle to actually examine what's going on in RTO markets. But unfortunately, the Commission issued a final rule in October, Order Number 719, in which it's ordered RTOs to make compliance filings only in four discrete areas. And it found that the broader issues that APPA and other consumer representatives wanted to raise were beyond the scope of the proceeding. They did this even though the Government Accountability Office had issued a report only weeks before, calling into question FERC's assertion that RTO markets benefit consumers. The GAO found that FERC had done no empirical analysis of its own to support its position that RTOs benefit the economy, nor has FERC developed a comprehensive set of publicly available standardized measures to help evaluate RTO performance. To sum up, these markets are highly complex, centrally administered, subject only to the lightest hands of regulation, and they have limited data transparency. We believe both retail and wholesale customers have suffered as a result. And as I say in my testimony, if you're not appalled, you haven't been yet paid attention to this. We have developed a proposal to reform RTO markets, which we put out in a white paper called Consumers in Peril. I have a very limited number of copies with me. Simply put, we want to streamline RTO operations by maintaining the functions that they perform well and trying to scale back the scope of the RTO-run markets. To reduce the pervasive price-setting role, APPA suggests that most electricity transactions should take place over longer-term bilateral contracts with load-serving entities, such as Pennsylvania's utilities and generators. Now, there's direct contracts between the two of them rather than going through the centralized market. Future generation adequacy would be assured through these contracts instead of through an RTO-run capacity market. The RTOs would operate an optimization market around the edges just to operate with imbalances, to allow people to lay off excess energy. And finally, we've proposed much more data transparency. This is not the only RTO reform proposal that we've seen. American Forest and Paper Association, Portland Cement have also put out proposals, and there are well-known academics right here in Pennsylvania at Penn State and Carnegie Mellon who also have their ideas. We hope more ideas emerge. We think this discussion needs to take place. I will close by just offering some suggestions about what you all might be able to do, because frankly, your retail customers and our wholesale customers are in very similar circumstances. First, restructured states can reduce their purchases from the RTO-run spot market through requirements that their utilities develop diversified, longer-term power supply portfolios, as well as possibly utility construction of or participation in new generation. Second, you can enhance and develop new energy efficiency programs and demand response programs. These measures limit your need to take power out of the wholesale market, and that de-emphasizes the price formation role of those markets. I understand some of these steps are now possible since House Bill 2200 has passed, but I am no expert in that bill, I want to hasten to add. We also urge this commission to take a more active role in communicating its concerns about RTO markets, both to FERC and to your congressional delegation. The passage of House Bill 2200 was an important first step for your state, but you cannot by yourself, you know, just insulate yourself completely from the wholesale market. With a new administration coming in, there will be new opportunities to advocate for meaningful reforms. It is important for FERC to feel the pain of Pennsylvania's retail electric customers and to take stronger action to ensure that wholesale power supply rates are indeed just and reasonable as the Federal Power Act requires. Thank you for allowing me to appear before you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chairman.
Judge, I'm going to defer to my colleagues first.
Vice Chairman Christie.
Thank you. First off, thank you for coming up today and putting all the time that you put into the preparation of this testimony. We very much appreciate it. You just mentioned the House Bill 2200 that we just passed in Pennsylvania. I think it's important to note that House Bill 2200 does a lot of things and will do a lot of good things for Pennsylvania. However, the one thing that it doesn't do is touch upon the wholesale power market itself. Approximately 70-80% of a customer's bill is related to this wholesale power market. And no matter what procurement technology you use, short-term, medium, long-term, if you're required to buy from this wholesale market, and if you don't like those prices, it doesn't really matter what kind of procurement technology that you utilize. So I believe it's incumbent upon us to seriously dive into these RTO-related issues, and because that's where the big dollars are for the consumers in Pennsylvania. On your testimony, I noticed on page 3 a very, I'll call it a very powerfully persuasive graph on where the rates have gone with deregulated states versus the regulated states. And I just want to make sure I understand this correctly, that in those states that have adopted deregulation versus the states that have decided to remain regulated, that there's approximately a 56% price difference?
That's what it says.
Okay. That's fairly impressive. Jumping around a little bit, on page 6 of your testimony, something that really caught my eye was related to these financial transmission rights and the default of the tower company amounting to approximately $85 million worth of defaults.
My understanding is that that's what was estimated by PJM at the time of the default, and that was for a period from November of last year through May of this year. I am not sure what the final number may have turned out to be, but that was what was estimated at the time.
And so those costs are basically absorbed by all of the load-serving entities within PJM that's spread out as far as the default payments?
Well, my hope is that some of that will be disgorged from the tower companies themselves, and we commend PJM for having filed the complaint, and their market monitor for having, you know, looked at the bidding patterns and, you know, decided that something fishy was going on there. They gave that information to PJM, and PJM filed the complaint against the tower companies. Our hope is that we will get at least some of that back. But yes, I mean, because PJM itself is, an LLC that's basically just working with other people's money, it does not have the reserves to absorb that kind of shortfall and will have to be collected from other entities, including entities that serve loads within PJM.
My main concern here is we're right in the middle of a financial meltdown with our financial system related to the mortgage crisis and the derivative positions that have been taken by, to this day, still an unknown number of quantities and entities and billions of dollars worth of impacts. My fear here is that do we have any handle or grip on how many derivative positions are being taken with respect to our energy market, and whether or not these type of positions have an ability to cause the same kind of havoc that might have happened in the mortgage business?
Of course, I personally know. We just have this nagging concern that the activities of these players has been, you know, a way that money is kind of going out of the market. We have members in the MISO region who have been expressing concerns about the activities of financial players. And I'm not saying they're hiding anything. I mean, they are participating in the markets like other market participants, but they are not hedging load. They are not buying power to serve customers. They are doing this to play, you know, the difference at the arbitrage. And we do have some figures that indicate that in the FTR market in MISO, it appears it's about $100 million a year is taken out by those parties. And, you know, MISO's point is that's a relatively small share of that market overall. My view is $100 million is a lot of money. And that's money that customers, and they're actually, FTR shortfalls, those are not often fully funded. Our concern is that part of the reason they're not fully funded is that monies are going out of the market. And what we've just asked for is we'd like to see more investigation of this and a better understanding of the role, but every time we raise the issue, we're told, oh, Ms. Kelly, they add liquidity. How could you question their participation? I think it's a lot easier to question their participation in the current market environment myself, but, we'll see.
It might not be a fair question for you, but I'll ask it anyhow. With Constellation, are you familiar with the trouble that they experienced and why they may have gotten into trouble and why the Warren Buffett is looking at buying Constellation in a sort of a fire sale? Do you have any knowledge of what's happening
there? I do not have any direct knowledge of it, and I would be a bad girl if I speculated out of school. But what I can say is when you engage in energy trading, you have to basically be able to meet collateral calls. And our members, and the reason I know this is our members have the same issues when we use, contracts. We have to be able to meet collateral calls. If your credit is downgraded or you have some kind of problem, there can definitely be a downward spiral effect where you're asked to provide additional collateral because your credit rating has gone down or there's been other adverse financial consequences for you. And that can then snowball because if that happens, then there's more adverse impacts, and then your credit rating goes down again, and then you have more calls, and that's how Enron went down. And our members have concerns about that as well. And I know that Constellation was heavily involved in those kinds of trading activities. Once you start down that road, it can snowball very quickly. But I do not have any specific knowledge about Constellation, and I would be out of school if I said I did.
Okay. On page 8 of your testimony, you dive into the situation where Edison Mission basically engaged in a high offer strategy to boost the prices under the locational marginal pricing system in PJM. And it looks like they were fined approximately $7 million. Do we have any idea of just how much they may have profited from this high offer strategy? Does anyone have a feel for how many millions of dollars that they may have made off of the strategy?
Well, that is the $64,000 plus inflation question. No, we do not have any idea because all we have is the settlement that was entered into by the Office of Enforcement Staff and FERC. And if you review the terms of that settlement, there was absolutely nothing said about what the impact was on PJM customers of this strategy. Now, you are correct that it would appear that if you're bidding in part of your generation at a very, very high rate right before the cap, the terms that have been used to describe that kind of practice are economic withholding. In other words, you're technically making it available, but you're making it available at such a high price that the chances of taking are very unlikely. Hockey stick bidding, that kind of thing. It was a questionable enough practice that the market monitor referred it to FERC. I have to assume he did that for a reason. I have talked to experts who have looked at the same kind of bidding practices in ERCOT, who indicate, one, yes, it can be very lucrative, and two, it's fiendishly difficult to go back and rerun that market. What you have to do is if those bids had come at a different level, what would the market result have had to be? And you have to rerun those markets for, every hour for 2.5 years. So that's a very complicated financial analysis that has to be undertaken and simply underscores how complex these markets have become and how difficult they can be to police. But the answer to your question is we have no idea, and that's one of the reasons why I am so disturbed about the lack of data transparency. We don't have access to the bids. As I said, the identity of the bidders are masked, and then the bids themselves don't come out till a number of months later. So no, we don't, and that's one of the reasons why I find this whole phenomenon so troubling, is there's not really a way for anybody else to go in and try and figure this out.
I would agree with you that this is troublesome. When we look at Section 205 and 206 of the Federal Power Act and the requirement that FERC-regulated public utilities are to charge rates that are just and reasonable, How do we know if we're getting just and reasonable rates if we don't know the cost of the generators, if we don't see that data, nor do we get to see the generator bids until months after they have been tendered? It just seems to me that there's not enough transparency or open exchange of information here for, I know for us, to come to a conclusion, are we getting just and reasonable rates from this RTO structure?
I want to start by saying that there is definitely case law out there that says that market forces can be used to discipline rates to just and reasonable levels. You know, FERC is not violating the law to have that strategy. But they must be able to show that the competitive forces are disciplining those rates to competitive levels and, you know, that is keeping rates just and reasonable. It is very difficult for anybody else besides FERC to figure that out in the absence of the data, and especially, you know, we don't have any other form in which we can take those concerns because they've indicated that they are the sole arbiter of whether rates are just and reasonable in that market. So yes, we are very troubled by the lack of data transparency. I would note that in order number 719, which is the final rule that I referred to, they did indicate that there is an opportunity in the stakeholder processes that RTOs are going to be undertaking to file their compliance programs. One of the items that is available for discussion within that compliance process is data transparency. And they specifically noted how many months delay on the release of the bidding data and whether identities of bidders should be masked. So that is an opportunity to advocate within the FERC process for broader data transparency. And we're hoping that our members take advantage of that, and we hope that you would too.
You know, I have some real concern in this issue that we're not getting just and reasonable rates. Last month we had a hearing, and I asked a specific question about, well, what is a just and reasonable rate in a competitive market? And the comment came back that, well, a just and reasonable rate is if you're at cost or maybe 10% above your cost, then that would be deemed to be a reasonable profit margin systematic of a competitive market. But the problem I have, and the very simple data that I have seen, is that in Pennsylvania, over 90% of our generation comes from coal and nuclear facilities that have a very low running cost. And I'll be generous here and say that their average running cost is 3 cents a kilowatt hour. But last year, the clearing price in PJM, or year to date in PJM, it's upwards in the 7-8 cent range, which is a factor of at least 2 or 3 times the actual cost of generation. So somebody has to explain to me how we're getting a competitive market here with these rates being so much high above the actual cost. I'm missing something here.
Well, we actually, in the submission that we made in the FERC docket and in our attempt to get them to broaden the scope of the proceeding to look at price formation in RTO markets, we submitted 2 affidavits. One of them was by a financial expert named Edward Bodmer. Mr. Bodmer looked at the profitability of sellers into the PJM market, and the data that he found for the 5 largest sellers was at that, you know, fairly compelling that they were making a level of profits that would be considerably above. He compared them to a control group of regulated utilities. The profits that they were making were very substantially above that level. He also looked at some of the presentations that had been made by these companies to Wall Street analysts, and they indicated that, you know, this was a year or two ago, once the RPM comes in and we start getting those dollars, and once the rate caps start coming off in states, we'll be getting even more dollars. So there is no question that there's a set of generators who are doing exceedingly well in these markets, although I would note that one of them was Constellation, and yet, you know, we now know that they are in the arms of Warren Buffett. You know, I'll leave greater minds than mine to figure out how they could make that happen, but they did. At any rate, so there are certain generators who are definitely making a lot of money, and I will also acknowledge that there are other generators who are out on the margin who may not be making all the money that they need to be making. So we're in this situation where some are being grossly overcompensated and others may not be making enough, and yet we seem to have these mechanisms to ensure that everybody makes enough. I've kind of in the past indicated I thought this was like no generator left behind. You know, we have a special plan for every child. But, you know, all I can tell you is that we too are very disturbed by this. Our members are out in these markets. They're trying to buy power, and they are really suffering. So I share your concern.
I have just one more question. In 1996, we had the traditional vertically integrated utility system, cost of service regulation, and we decided as a state to move away from that and push generation into a market. And in 1996, there really wasn't a market. And there really wasn't a textbook of what this market should look like or how it should be structured. But over the past 12 years, we've watched this market be developed with the different pricing schemes that have been developed by PJM and with FERC oversight. And I really think it's time now for us to take a step back and look at, well, what did we get here and what do we have and what's working right and what needs to be modified. You mentioned in the report here on page 11 that the U.S. Government Accountability Office recently came out with a statement that that they found that FERC has not conducted any empirical analysis to support its position regarding the workability of the RTOs. Do we have any idea of what will happen next as a result of this USGAO comment? Where does it go now?
Well, the GAO study is the GAO study. It was done for two senators. That report was delivered to those senators. And so GAO's at this moment, its duties are at an end. It has done the report. It has made public the report. We were hoping, because this report came out before Order 719 did, we were hoping that this might give the commission some pause and perhaps give them a reason to go back and look at it as to whether they should broaden the scope of the... Is that my half hour? Anyway, I'll continue to talk over that if that's possible. Or is this a fire drill? Should I get up and go?
I think it's just my speaker up here, which means I need to shut up now and let my other colleagues ask some questions.
Okay. At any rate, we were hopeful that the commission might take that into account and recast its final rule or make some different determinations, but when the rule finally did come out a few weeks later, it was clear there was not a mention of the report in there anywhere. So it's likely that nothing may happen, or it's likely that somebody else may pick up that report in Congress and indicate, you know, gee, sounds like we need to do a little more field work here. Maybe there might be another GAO study, or maybe there might be an oversight hearing that Congress might hold to ask about questions about the report. But, you know, as to GAO's duties, they are officially now at an end unless and until they're asked to do another report.
Thank you.
Commissioner Patton?
Thank you. Sue, thank you for freeing up some time to be with us here today. I want to talk a little bit about Pennsylvania in terms of what we've done with renewable sources here as it relates to your testimony. As you know, we've been one of the leaders with the passage of AEPS legislation, setting a target of 2018, an 18% renewable mandate. And I'm going to read from one of our leading environmental groups here in Pennsylvania, Penn Futures, talking about competitive PJM markets boosting wind, solar, and renewable energy sources. And the fact is that they believe that the renewables are really benefited by the PJM marketplace. In fact, they're being recognized with wind capacity markets. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that. And also as a backdrop, since 1996, when we passed our Deregulation Act, we have seen over 8,000 new megawatts of power put into the Pennsylvania marketplace by non-incumbent generators, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well.
Yes, first of all, I should tell you that APPA is a strong supporter of renewable development as well. And we have seen renewables develop both inside and outside RTOs. We have members in the Pacific Northwest who have been very diligent in contracting for new wind. So I think I would just like to lay to rest the myth that, you know, all RTO development and, you know, all renewable development takes place in RTOs. That is not true. It takes place both inside and it takes place outside. I would also like to add that the features of RTO development that allow better integration of wind in the view of some, if you kind of strip back the layers of that, it's really the broader operation, the broader market scope. It's a broader control area. There's more ability because you have more loads and resources to better deal with the intermittency and variability of resources like wind. And we don't have any quarrel with any of that. As I said, we are not RTO haters. And we believe a broader control area, planning across a broader region, non-discriminatory acts across a broader region, that's okay. So I just want to make clear to you, and even under our proposal, there would be a what I call the reconciliation market, you know, that would allow intermittent resources to enter into their resources. We understand that they cannot indicate with great accuracy what their schedules are going to be from hour to hour, and we too support wind development. So I just want to let you know that we don't think that the full panoply of markets is necessarily required to support, you know, having a greater amount of renewables. And we believe that they could be accommodated. For example, if you went into a load serving entity by entity procurement process here in Pennsylvania, that you, the commission, would have the ability to look at the proposed power portfolios to, you know, and if you believe it's a public policy goal to have a substantial amount of wind or biomass or run-of-the-river hydro or, you know, whatever you think, that can be accommodated through an IRP process. And in fact, I think renewable generation, as we did a study on this one as well, that we found there's a lot of trouble with long-term contracting in RTO regions. But one of the exceptions to that is that renewables often need long-term contracts. They need the revenue stream for a 10 or 20-year period to get off the ground. And people, because they have to meet renewable portfolio standards, are more willing to contract with them for that. So that's kind of an exception to the generally sad picture about long-term contracting in RTO regions. And part of it is because of RPSs in different states, and part of it is because the developers require those long-term contracts.
In the case, just as a follow-up, though, in the case of PJM, we see it working here in this marketplace. Do you agree with that?
It works outside RTOs, too.
Okay.
You know, so I can't say it's because of PJM that this has worked. It's because there's RPSs. It's because we're making it a policy that we need to have more renewable generation. It's because we're trying to take steps to make the system more friendly, to heavy up transmission, to, you know, allow, for example, FERC in Order 890, which is in non-RTO regions, did tiered imbalance penalties, in part to accommodate wind. They came up with two new transmission rate schedules, conditional firm and one other, that is supposed to accommodate wind. And as I say, my members in non-RTO regions, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, are not so hot about the idea of having an RTO in their region. They're very hot about the idea of having more renewable resources.
My last question for you, and I read this from a publication that hit my desk this week from CAPIC. And it's a quote from all of the FERC commissioners. I'll start with the chairman. I have been impressed with the steady progress made in organized markets. I'll quote Democratic Commissioner Sudeen Kelly. Regional wholesale markets are a real success story. I'll go down to Commissioner Phil Mueller. Competitive markets deliver to customers in a way that non-competitive markets do not. And then John Wellinghoff, Democrat. Rising costs for electricity are fairly uniform and hitting everywhere around the country. It's not that we have higher increase in RTO regions, not outside of those RTO regions. Inside and outside organized wholesale markets, it's happening across the country. And then finally, Commissioner Mark Spitzer says we need to stay the course on markets. Your thoughts on what the five FERC commissioners seem to agree on?
Far be it from me to criticize the thinking of the five great Americans. I would just note to you,
well, I'd ask.
that would be a career-limiting move for me, and I will not engage in it. I would just simply note that we participated in the proceeding, and those actually all come from the open meeting where they issued Order 719, those statements. And I was in the audience there, so I heard them personally. I would just simply note to you that we participated in that proceeding in good faith for a year and a half, that we raised our issues there for a year and a half. We put in all the Emory studies in the record. There was a filing made by 41 consumer side interests, everybody from the AARP to the Consumer Federation of America, to ELCON, to us, to hospital associations in Ohio. 41 parties came in and said, please broaden the scope of this proceeding to look at RTO markets. And those, as a political matter, those pleas have not been successful. And all I can tell you is that I'm hopeful in next year that perhaps a fresh look may be taken at that.
And you mentioned 41 parties supporting your claim, but for the record, 82 parties.
Yes.
twice the number supporting wholesale electric power market.
And we were very, I gotta say, amused when that filing came in with the number 82. Some of the entities or people that they resorted to in order to come up with 82 included individual lawyers in private practice in Washington, D.C. Had we wanted to go out and recruit that kind of entity to join in the 82-party motion, I'm sure we could have found it, but, you know, all I can tell you is it's the quality as well as the quantity.
I'm not into conspiracy theories here at the hearing today, so thank you very much for your time.
You are most welcome, sir. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Pittman.
Thank you. Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry, I thought you were kicking me out.
Okay. Not yet. I'm going to your recommendations on page 12. It appears you have at least two that we have direct jurisdiction over. As the chairman mentioned, our jurisdiction over the wholesale markets is certainly very limited. You recommend two things, a mixed portfolio approach and also enhanced energy efficiency and demand-side response programs. I think that Act 129, which was signed by Governor Rendell into law in mid-October, which was House Bill 2200, certainly addresses those two recommendations. Are there any other recommendations that you have for us that we have direct jurisdiction over?
I will say that I did look at that bill. Again, I am not an expert. Please don't ask me about it. But I did look at that, and I noticed that a lot of the implementation of that is in your hands. And so I guess my plea to you would be to use those authorities to the fullest and to, you know, make sure that whatever power portfolios are done to provide default service in Pennsylvania are very well considered, thought out, have a different variety of fuels, different varieties of kinds of contracts, different, you know, in other words, that you truly diversify your portfolio. And I think that's very important, and that's what our members are trying to do. Those of us who have the wherewithal to own generation or trying to build new generation or to enter into long-term contracts to anchor new generation proposed by others. Some of them are entering into 5 to 10 year deals. Some of them are, you know, you have to diversify your portfolio so that you are not stuck with any one bad bet, frankly. The other thing I would note is that I did put in my testimony the concept of actually building new generation or owning it, and my quick review of your bill didn't seem to mention anything about that. So I don't know if you would permit your load-serving utilities to go back into the generation business themselves as opposed to buying from third parties. But I know that one of the strategies of our members is to try to participate in new generation themselves. You know, a lot of them are too small to build a 600-megawatt plant, but they can buy a 30-megawatt slice. You know, so that's, I guess, I would recommend that. And again, I would also recommend energy efficiency and demand response to beat the band. The less load you're buying for, the more insulated you are. Did that answer your question?
Thank you. I think that Act 129 provides us a framework to move forward on many of those energy efficiency and demand-side response programs. One other question. We've been recipients of a letter that has gone to the governor at least three times, and I'll just pull out a little quote from that and try and get your feedback and trying to rectify your views on the wholesale market coupled with theirs. This was presented to the governor from Pennsylvania Electricity Consumers and Employers. And this is a quote: "We believe that regional competitive wholesale markets for electricity with independent oversight, as we have in the PJM marketplace, provide access to generation at the lowest available cost, promote transparency and reliability, enhance the nation's transmission infrastructure, and provide price signals that promote sound investment decisions regarding generation using renewable energy as well as more traditional sources, transmission, demand response, and energy efficiency." And that letter was signed by 7-Eleven, Acme, Best Buy, Big Lots, Einstein and Noah, JCPenney, Leggett and Flat, Macy's, PetSmart, Safeway, Walmart, and Yum Brands, Inc. Any thoughts on their letter and their support?
Well, yes, I do have some thoughts on that, but I actually would defer to our witness from Alcoa, who is himself an end user and I think has some thoughts on this topic as well. I would just say that what you're seeing here in Pennsylvania is kind of an echo of the greater national debate, where you have entities on one side of the issue who are saying these markets are great, these markets, you know, support competition. If you oppose these markets, you hate competition. And that has never been our position. We just do not think that the specific features of these markets support competition. And, as I put in my testimony, we think there are serious flaws for them, you know, in them, worthy of examination. What you have is a series of well-financed lobbying groups who think that, you know, who are able to use these kinds of efforts to put their views on competitive markets out there. And I don't deny they're out there, and I'm sure they honestly believe those thoughts. But when you look at consumers, especially representatives of residential consumers, as opposed to Walmart, who I believe knows how to defend itself and to negotiate good deals for everything from Barbies to power, and you look at those consumers who do not have the same wherewithal to protect themselves and to negotiate in the market, what you'll see is Nasuka, you'll see even Elcon, large customers who are able to negotiate for themselves as best as they can. Our entities, consumer-owned power, the co-ops, people who are on the receiving end of these markets are really quite concerned about them. And, you know, all I can tell you is, yes, there is that division of opinion. It's been raging in Washington for a number of years. The GAO noted it in its report. If you look at the appendix, there's this whole series of studies. There's their studies, there's our studies. But the independent federal agency that's supposed to be the arbiter of this and who's supposed to do its homework on whether these markets are actually doing what they said they're doing has not undertaken its own analysis of it. And I would refer back to the statements of the commissioners that you noted. They do not have their own staff's analysis to back up those statements. They are relying on third parties. And they are relying, frankly, on one set of third parties, and they are ignoring the concerns raised by another set of third parties. That's just the truth.
Thank you. I don't know if the judge or the chairman noted that reply comments post today's hearings are going to be accepted on or before November 17th.
Thank you for reminding me.
As usual, I have very limited comments to make, and that is just to say thank you very much, Ms. Kelly, for coming in. I am deeply appreciative of your testimony, which is very well prepared, and your responses to the questions that have been offered to you are outstanding. Thank you again.
You're most welcome. It was my pleasure to appear.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. We appreciate your coming.
Now I can leave?
Please.
Okay.
May I ask you a few too?
I was wondering that maybe he might want to, but okay.
Oops.
I also read carefully your recommendations to us. You'll be happy to know that Act 129 of 2008 will permit us to do much of what you recommend, and in fact we were already down, quite well down the way of encouraging conservation and energy efficiency. And the bill codifies a regulation which we promulgated 2 years ago regarding a portfolio approach to the acquisition of wholesale supply for default customers, those who do not switch to a competitive supplier, an alternative supplier. We're waiting to see how that plays out. The legislation permits 25% of a default service supplier, a utility supplier, purchasing for customers who don't switch, to utilize long-term contracts. We have been criticized a little bit for, in our regulation that preceded this legislation, criticized for putting an emphasis on no more than 3 years as a long-term contract because of our view, at least some of our view, longer than 3 years is so speculative that it's not really possible to enter into a contract at a fixed price that will track market forces. In other words, there are those of us who are very concerned that if you go out too far with a long-term contract, power will become available at a price far below the contract price, and yet that power cannot be resorted to, and customers will still have to pay the long-term contracted for price. and is further concerned that the market price may actually get way above the contract price, and the supplier will find some reason to insist on renegotiating the contract, or will threaten bankruptcy so that the supplier can get out of the contract and sell the power to someone else at a higher price. So these are concerns. We're really anxious to see what is proposed to us. I think we are of a mind that a longer-term contract, even as much as 20 years, might be appropriate in order to ensure system reliability or to bring along a project that would be good for Pennsylvania that would otherwise not be financeable if it didn't have that kind of a contract behind it. As long as that kind of a long-term contract does not overwhelm the portfolio, if you will, and destroy the cost averaging and risk averaging qualities of a portfolio. So I was intrigued when you said that there were some problems with long-term contracts. Are those the kinds of things that you were referring to, that there are problems with long-term contracts and RTOs?
Well, part of the problems is it's very hard to get them in RTOs. Believe me, we are believers in long-term contracts, especially as a way to anchor new generation, as you noted. It's very difficult to finance any kind of new plant construction unless you have somebody who's on the hook to pay for a substantial amount of time. You are also correct that you shouldn't have 100% of your power supply portfolio in 20-year contracts. You don't want to do that. It's like diversifying your 401k. You want to try and, of course, that didn't work so well for us, did it? But bad example. But you want to try and diversify the different kinds of investments that you have in power supply. And you would want a mix of owned and purchased. You would want a mix of lengths. You would want a mix of fuels. But we do believe firmly that there's a place for long-term contracts. And our members outside of RTOs who deal in what we call the bilateral markets generally have contracts of substantially longer term for a substantial portion of their power supply portfolio. And I think even within RTO regions, there's been the recent credit situation, I think, has kind of fundamentally recalibrated what it's going to take to get new construction built. And I think that you're going to see that there's going to be a lot more need for that kind of contract going forward to anchor new construction. And I actually have some, there was a recent hearing at FERC in which a witness from one of the financial houses who helps do these projects indicated that, it used to be you could get a 6 or 7 years or, but now it's going to be longer than that if you want to finance any kind of new construction. I think with the retrenchment in the credit markets, they're going to want to see a longer term commitment to take away the power in order to be able to finance a facility. So the ground is shifting under our feet, frankly, even as we're working on these policies. The problem that our members have is that because of the single clearing price mechanism and the profits that Commissioner Christie mentioned, when you go to contract forward, what you get is offers that are basically the forward price curve of what the price is in the clearing price market. In other words, they'll just take that contract, put it out 5 years, take that price, and then do a premium because you're taking them out of the market, and therefore they could make even more money. So, what our members have seen are very high prices for longer-term contracts, which is why some of our members are building, because their view is, at least I own the resource instead of renting the resource. At least the cost of that resource will come in at its cost because it's my cost, and I'm not putting on a markup. And it's not an easy environment to build in, don't get me wrong. That has its own set of problems, but the fact of the matter is that continuing to rely on this market is scary enough to enough of our members that many of them are trying to build their own new generation.
Just as a final note, you also recommend that we take a more active role in communicating our concerns to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and to our congressional delegation. Mm-hmm. We're doing that as well. We have internally already decided to double our federal advocacy team. And I think you'll see us talking to our congressional delegation more, because we have some problems. PJM knows it, and
particularly with the reliability pricing model, which we think needs a lot of work.
Please don't take my testimony to have said that I did not think you were undertaking advocacy efforts before. I know firsthand that you have. The amount of participation that you've done in different PJM proceedings, participating in the stakeholder processes, which are very time-consuming and resource-intensive. I know you all have been doing that, but somehow we need to kind of, I guess, take it to another level to make it clear in a macro sense that these are serious, serious concerns that need to be addressed next year.
Thank you again for your testimony.
And now do I go?
Now you're left.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You
I appreciate
much.
It. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have the honor of introducing Mr. Bob Weichmann, the attorney in private practice, representing the PJM Industrial Customer Coalition, and Bert Weather's Youth for Works School. He's a longtime member of the bar.
Good afternoon, Chairman Colley and Commissioners. PJM Industrial Customer Coalition appreciates the opportunity to participate in this second en banc public hearing regarding the current and future wholesale electricity markets. I am Bob Weisar, McNeese Wallace. Our firm has the privilege of serving as counsel to the PJM Industrial Customer Coalition. Just a little background on PJM ICC. PJM ICC is a coalition of 31 industrial and institutional customers of electricity. Many of the PJM ICC companies own and operate significant electricity consuming facilities here in Pennsylvania. PJM ICC was organized back in 1996, back when PJM underwent its substantial restructuring, and has been active in the PJM stakeholder process in proceedings before FERC, and recently, and out of necessity, before the U.S. Congress on all matters that affect wholesale electricity prices in the PJM region. PJM ICC members are extremely frustrated with the performance of organized markets and with FERC's performance relative to organized markets. PJM ICC companies in deregulated states that have already removed rate caps have closed facilities. PJM ICC companies in deregulated states that have not yet removed rate caps are earnestly attempting to inject rationality and practicality in wholesale electricity markets before those rate caps expire. PJM ICC companies in still regulated jurisdictions, and there are quite a few, have focused their attention on shielding their plants from PJM market prices. The Federal Power Act was designed to protect customers. Given the Federal Power Act's overarching mandate, FERC should be listening closely to sophisticated customers that are active in highly competitive global markets. They are not. And when customers of all types and sizes from all areas in which organized markets exist pleaded with FERC to take a hard look at organized markets, we hoped FERC would listen. They did not. FERC's recently issued final rule on organized markets, to which Sue alluded, takes us back a step, in my opinion, by passing up an excellent opportunity to begin to get things right. FERC's final rule on organized markets adds to customers' frustration. Our frustration is driven not only by higher and more volatile electricity prices, although both are causes for concern. Industrial customers understand, as well as anyone understands, that high and volatile fuel prices do contribute in part to high and volatile electricity prices. What is frustrating, though, is that the rate of increase is noticeably higher in states exposed to organized markets than it is in other states, notwithstanding the original intent of restructuring to close the gap between the high-cost states and the low-cost states. As Mr. Hughes from Elkhorn will testify today, one of the best measures of regulated versus deregulated prices is a comparison that isolates nearly all variables except the customer's exposure to organized market prices. Consider the following real-life example. A customer has two plants with nearly identical operating characteristics, one in Maryland, in which customers are directly exposed now to PJM market prices, and one in West Virginia, where rates are still regulated based on actual cost. Both plants are customers of the same utility, Allegheny Power System in this case. The only difference is that one plant has the good fortune of being located in West Virginia, and the other has the burden of being located in Maryland, where customers are directly exposed to PJM prices. You'll see on figure one of my statement, in 1997, the two plants paid nearly identical prices, just over 3 cents per kilowatt hour, the good old days. However, as of August 2008, a very large differential has developed between the two plants. The West Virginia plant now pays just under 4 cents per kWh, an increase of less than 33% over the 9-year period. The Maryland plant, in sharp contrast, now pays more than 7 cents per kilowatt hour, an increase in excess of 100% over the same 9-year period. When all variables are isolated except for exposure to organized market prices, it becomes clear that customers are not benefiting from the PJM market design, and many are being seriously harmed. I also include in my statement as figure two a chart that was shared with us by Gerdau Ameristeel, one of the PJM ICC companies. Gerdau has 18 manufacturing facilities across the United States. All but one are located in the Eastern Interconnect. Of the 18 facilities, the four plants with the highest electricity prices are all located in single clearing price markets. The three highest price plants are all located in PJM. The fourth is located in ERCOT, which also has a single clearing price market, albeit not yet with a locational aspect. What is not shown in the bar chart, but what I know from experience with this company, is that the rate of increase is also higher in the single clearing price markets than it is in regulated jurisdictions or under other market designs. Let's skip over to page three and what we perceive to be the fundamental problem. The single clearing price mechanism, while generally supported in most economic circles, has been shown to have significant shortcomings when confronted with the real-world realities of structural market power, substantial mitigation, demand inelasticity, and overarching societal preferences for reliable power. We all value reliability, industrials do, residentials, commercials. In the face of these realities, FERC has taken an approach toward market design that layers revenue streams from energy, ancillary service, and capacity markets until all units needed for reliability have at least enough revenue to cover their revenue requirements. The most expensive unit needed for reliability receives enough revenue to remain financially viable, and because all lower cost units also receive revenue based on the clearing price, most units in the PJM generation stack are receiving far more than their actual revenue requirements. As evident from the comparisons of retail rates in regulated versus deregulated states, the claimed benefits of lower outage rates, increased operational efficiency, and shifting investment risk from ratepayers to shareholders, all of which are acknowledged benefits from organized markets, are being dwarfed by the price run-ups at the retail level that result from a single clearing price mechanism. The disconnect occurs because the current FERC-approved market design ignores completely the State Commission's rate decisions issued over a period of decades. The FERC-approved market designs start from the assumption, as they must for the theory to work, that all generation units are essentially new units and that the capital costs and operating costs are meaningful determinants of the efficiency and competitiveness of all those units. Of course, that is not the case. And as a consequence of this mistaken threshold assumption, the left side of the supply curves, whether it's the energy or capacity or ancillary service markets, but particularly in the capacity markets, is loaded with units that have low costs simply because ratepayers have already picked up depreciation tabs and stranded cost tabs for a long period of time. Yet the differential between the clearing price and those low actual costs never benefits ratepayers. The differential, known in economic parlance as inframarginal revenue, or also called production efficiencies, goes directly to the shareholders owning the units. So we are left with a design that is premised upon what Sue calls the no generation left behind pricing policy. Instead of targeting customer payments to the actual revenue requirements of each unit in the fleet, we are now ignoring revenue requirements altogether, except for the revenue requirement of the most expensive unit needed to reliably serve load. We then pay all generators as if they, too, carried that most expensive revenue requirement. I include in my presentation some supply and demand curves from a recent RPM auction just to illustrate the concept that to the left side of the supply curve, when you take into account inframarginal revenue and mitigation, the net avoided cost rate for almost all units in the capacity market in this case is zero. So of the 135,000 megawatts that cleared, the net ACR in this case for 115,000 of those megawatts is $0 per megawatt day. Let's move on to a potential solution. I say a potential solution. We're not saying that this is the solution and not the only solution. We're certainly open to ideas. When FERC proposed a rulemaking to fix the organized markets, we were cautiously optimistic. Based on that cautious optimism, PJM ICC joined with the Portland Cement Association and other industrial groups to file with FERC an alternative market design proposal, AMDP or design. The design proposes the use of competition and market forces, but only where those dynamics can be used to drive efficiency and reduce customer cost. The design stops short, though, of carrying economic theory to illogical extremes. Like cost of service models, the design ensures that capital recovery payments by customers entitle those customers to paying only actual unit-specific variable costs, not the bid submitted by the least efficient unit. The combined effect of this capacity and energy payment structure is to provide generation owners with a reasonable opportunity to collect revenues consistent with the revenue requirement of their units, while ensuring that cut consumers receive some value for their capacity payments in the form of fuel diversity and improved supply system efficiencies. The structure for capacity and energy pricing, with the potential for zonal differences based on real transmission constraints, an acknowledged feature of the electrical topology, also fits with the underlying physics of the system. This design attempts to create reasonable economic opportunities for both buyers, and in this case, load-serving entities and large customers, and suppliers to negotiate long-term bilateral contracts that would, over time, expose consumers to prices that more closely reflect long-run marginal costs, rather than to prices that reflect the recurring calculation of short-term marginal costs. In order to support new entry and investment, however, the design retains the existing functions of some RTOs as a default aggregator of load in order to reduce counterparty risk for generation developers and to enhance the efficiency of the overall system by integrating the transmission planning process into the generation supply auctions over a broad geographic area. The design depends, as it must, on transparent integrated resource planning of the entire system and integrating transmission planning with the generation procurement process. Those two have to fit together. The design, if properly implemented and administered by PJM, would provide consumers a lower all-in delivered cost than available today from the organized markets. The ultimate goal is to equilibrate revenue opportunities for owners of existing depreciated assets and owners of new generation assets. By injecting competition in the selection of generation resources, both new and existing, and in the dispatch of generation for energy imbalance service across broad geographic areas, while at the same time restoring the consumer benefits of generation asset depreciation, fuel diversity, and improved operational efficiencies, all of which we need, all of which are not being reflected now in retail prices. In short, the goal is an improved balance between the needs of investors and consumers than what is provided by the current market design of single clearing price energy and capacity markets. If this design is successful, we would expect all states to begin turning toward regional markets and RTO processes for solutions to their long-term needs, instead of retreating to or fiercely defending individual state approaches. On pages 6 and 7 and 8, I'm going to the details of the alternative market design proposal, the mechanics of what we are proposing. I'm not going to go through that. I'll take questions on that. In closing, a cure to the fundamental problems underlying unacceptably high electricity prices will not come easily. To achieve the best results, the current market design must be changed by FERC. For FERC to change those designs, FERC must be convinced that its market design choices are working against the public interest. Also, incumbent suppliers must be forced to accept the fact that extraordinarily high margins on wholesale power sales are not an acceptable norm. This commission and similarly situated state commissions must coalesce around an acceptable alternative. While PJM ICC has joined others in proposing the alternative market design proposal, the group welcomes all ideas and improvements that begin moving outcomes in a more customer-friendly direction. PJM ICC applauds this commission's initiative in scheduling hearings to examine the problems underlying current wholesale electricity market designs and the pressures those designs place on retail customers' prices. PJM ICC appreciates this opportunity to address the commission directly, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Weischer, for coming here today. Excellent testimony. I just have a few questions. Your organization has 31 industrial and institutional customers. Do you know approximately how many employees that represents?
It is in the tens of thousands.
And these are, I would presume that they're not minimum wage type of positions, but more family-sustaining positions?
That's correct. Mr. Charlone can speak to the kind of higher-than-average wages afforded by manufacturing companies, whether union or non-union, so yes.
Your chart on page 2 is very striking. The chart where you show for an industrial customer in Allegheny Power's territory being in West Virginia and the same customer being in the service territory of Allegheny Power in Maryland. Same utility, same employees, same transmission distribution lines. And the chart is showing that the rates are nearly double in the deregulated state versus the regulated state. My simple question is why would anyone who has a decision to make on where to put a new industrial plant, why would they ever go to one of the deregulated states now?
Yeah, the question applies equally to Figure 2. And when you're looking at electricity-intensive or energy-intensive manufacturing companies, the choices in terms of new capital deployment, upgrades to existing plants, and importantly, shifting production among facilities are all driven by these types of results, and we're seeing those in practice.
I think we have one, and well, maybe I'll ask the question for the Alcoa representative here later on. You talked about some of the fundamental problems with the RTO, and I guess you're not going to get much argument out of me. The one statistic that I find troublesome is that we have added over 10,000 megawatts of new generation in Pennsylvania since deregulation started, and over 90% of that generation has been natural gas fired. The concern I have on that is when we look at the single market clearing price, with the gas projects are the most expensive units, generally speaking, and that's setting the margin. So the more gas plants that we add, although we solve some reliability issues, we exacerbate the single market clearing price. Would you agree with that?
I would, and I see the proliferation of natural gas units, certainly environmental factors are driving that, but we've set up a market design that favors shorter-term solutions and shorter-term turnarounds. So natural gas units also have much lower capital costs and require lower capital investments than, say, a clean coal unit or a nuclear unit. So when you have a market design that favors shorter-term solutions and you're looking at capital deployment decisions, you would tend to favor lower capital investment type units. That, of course, on the energy side, it's a balancing on the capacity and energy, but that certainly increases energy prices under a single clearing market.
I just thought I'd get maybe your comments on the effectiveness of the RPM auctions that have been held. As I understand it, for a four-year period, we will have spent approximately $26 to $30 billion in payments to the generators for a certain amount of generation, which we're basically, I'll call it leasing. And I'm just curious on your thoughts on how happy you are with the results of the RPM program.
Needless to say, my clients are not at all happy with the RPM outcomes to date. And the claimed benefits of RPM, and there have been benefits, I think our view is that anytime you put that much money on the table, you will inevitably get some new generation, you will get upgrades, you will get reversals of retirement decisions. Our issue all along has been with proportionality. Is the amount of money we're putting on the table proportional to the increases in capacity and the upgrades? And under all reasonable calculations that we've done and that we've looked at, there is a strong disproportionality effect, and that's what troubles us. Is there a need for new generation in certain areas of PJM? Yes. Is the investment required for that new generation higher than it was 4 years ago or 5 years ago? Yes. Do we need to have fairly stable revenue streams in order to attract that capital? Yes. Our problem, though, is that when you deploy or set clearing prices or design a market to focus on that relatively small issue, but then take the results and multiply it by 135,000, that becomes exorbitantly expensive for customers. So again, are there issues? Yes. Do the issues need to be addressed? Yes. But is the amount of money proportional to the solutions we're seeing? And my clients have a very strong no to that question.
Well, I would tend to agree with you and your clients on that one, 100%. You have a number of suggested solutions, and I have to be honest here, I haven't gone through those in excruciating detail. But can you maybe describe some of the challenges that you might have in trying to get some of these alternative market design proposals implemented?
The biggest challenge, and FERC could do this tomorrow if it wanted to. FERC could issue an order and say, we FERC are changing the market design that we FERC approved. And FERC has that authority to do that after notice and opportunity to be heard, et cetera, et cetera. The challenge is convincing FERC that there's a problem. And as you heard from the statements that were read when Order 719 was released, there is not an acknowledgement of a problem. And until that acknowledgement occurs, our single biggest challenge is changing the mindset at FERC.
Thank you very much. We have a new president-elect, so there might be some changes at FERC. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us here today. I'm going to harken back to February 22nd, 1995, where Dave Kleppinger gave testimony on electric deregulation. I'm not going to ask you to, you know, if you're not comfortable with this, but you laid out 8 basic tenets you'd like to see in the competitive marketplace.
You said, one, market forces can do a better job of determining the price of a commodity, such as electricity, than can any governmental body. Agree with that?
Yeah, the alternative market design uses competition where we can use competition.
Second point, regulatory policies that inhibit the development of a competitive market for electricity should be modified. Thoughts on that?
Okay. Generally agree.
Point three, the full benefits of competition in the electricity supply industry will fully materialize only if retail competition is allowed.
And the alternative market design proposal does not preclude retail competition.
Okay. Point four, the monopoly transmission and distribution system must be accessible to any and all buyers and sellers on a non-discriminatory basis.
And orders, FERC orders 888, which were issued soon after, what was the date of the testimony, in 1995?
Correct.
Issued soon after my colleague's testimony. And followed up now by FERC Order 889, I think have taken significant steps toward that end.
Okay. And I'm not going to go through all eight. I want to, in deference to my colleagues, to ask some questions. But, you know, I recognize, you know, you guys, you have 100,000 members, I believe. Thirty-one members, 100,000 employees. Basically, you 25% of the industrial electric is consumed by your membership base. And we just did something here in Pennsylvania that I think really sets us up with demand-side response in Act 129. Your thoughts on where we should be going with Act 129 as it relates to your membership?
Commissioner, I'm speaking today on behalf of the PJM Industrial Customer Coalition, not Industrial Energy Consumers of Pennsylvania, which our firm is also counsel to. I'm not particularly versed in Act 129, so I'd be kind of beyond my level of expertise.
Thank you.
I would add, Mr. Commissioner, if I may, in 1996, when FERC was considering the concept of locational marginal pricing, and which has embedded in it a single clearing price mechanism, FERC held a technical conference, and you will find testimony presented on behalf of industrial customers at that technical conference in opposition to the single clearing price concept and in opposition to locational marginal pricing. We continue to support competition where we can to drive customer costs lower. We think that the designer's problem is the problem, not the concept of competition.
And I would agree with you. I think my colleague made the statement, you know, Pennsylvania's economic competitiveness in terms of having, you know, a robust wholesale power market where your members can have reliable power sources at an affordable rate. But I think for the audience here today, that cuts across all sectors of not only industry, but residential customers as well. And I get a fear of large industrials wanting to go back to the old way of doing business, where they negotiate directly with the incumbent utility to get what we'll call the sweetheart deal. And as you know, going into this new market environment, you know, we want to have a fair and balanced system. So, and you made a point earlier, you know, back under the old system, we would never see this new generation built here in Pennsylvania because, as you know, the old system, the leverage capital to do a project like that is on the back of the ratepayer. So we've seen, Commissioner Christie said 10,000 megawatts. I think I'm sticking to 8,000, but we'll dispute that later. But again, to see that coming from non-incumbent generators tells me that generation investment is coming to Pennsylvania, and that can only benefit your members in growing their businesses here in Pennsylvania.
That was a long-winded statement, Mr. Chairman, sorry. Oh, that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. I have no questions for you today, but thank you for coming and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming as well, and again, a very, I'm going to say smooth testimony, but I don't mean that in a condescending or insulting way.
I think that it was very straightforward and understandable, and I appreciate it. My question to you is twofold. Is one is, are your members individually approaching FERC with their concerns, or are they only going through your firm as the legal counsel to them?
It is a combination of both. The group's members don't always tell us when they reach out to FERC commissioners. I know they do. So the answer to your question is yes.
And I guess I should explain that the rationale for my questions goes back to earlier to Sue Kelly's testimony and request that the PUC, Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, is a little bit more aggressive in its pursuit of federal advocacy as well as in front of our congressional, U.S. congressional delegation. And so the question again is is your firm active in front of the Pennsylvania congressional delegation as well as your member companies?
Commissioner, at the outset, I noted that PJM ICC historically has been very active in the PJM stakeholder process, has been very active before FERC. It is only recently that we've perceived a need to kind of work more on the third leg of the stool, and that is more activity before Congress to raise the awareness of the problems and awareness of the issues. So within the last year, the answer is yes, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, because as you've heard earlier from the chairman, the PUC has become much more aggressive in its representation and will be more aggressive in its representation and advocacy before FERC and before the congressional delegation. And I think it's very important that individual citizens of Pennsylvania are also approaching the delegation and the FERC membership to reinforce this, the importance of this message. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Weishauer, thank you for coming today. Let me ask you just a few questions. On pages 1 and 2 of your prepared testimony, you describe a large customer in Maryland versus a large customer in West Virginia. And you say that the customer in Maryland is paying 7 cents a kilowatt hour versus 4 cents a kilowatt hour in West Virginia. Same company, two different plants. The Maryland customer is receiving a price that is subject to PJM prices, correct?
Yes.
Can you tell me, is that 7 cent rate from the default supplier or from an alternative supplier?
My understanding is it's from an alternative supplier.
So the default supplier would presumably be larger, with a higher price. So I think we can safely assume that that is the best price that that customer could get in Maryland.
That's a fair assumption. There are no rate caps anymore for that location in Maryland, so default supply is really not an option.
So that customer has, instead of taking supply from the default supplier, probably Baltimore Gas and Electric, PG&E, is probably going to an alternative supplier and negotiated a contract for 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Now let's look at the West Virginia customer. Do you know if that 4 cent price is that a negotiated rate or is that a tariffed rate in West Virginia?
My understanding is that, and I think indicates that is Allegheny's rate PP, which is the Allegheny Operating Company's standard tariff rate.
For large customers, industrial or large commercial customers?
Large industrial customers.
Large customers. Do you know what the residential rate in West Virginia is?
I don't know offhand.
Is it safe to assume that it's higher than 4 cents a kilowatt hour?
I would suspect that it is.
Yeah, I think so, too.
as it is in most states.
Do you know whether West Virginia law allows cross-subsidization between rent classes? Reasonable cross-subsidization between rent classes?
In which direction, Mr. Chairman? I know
can
the West
Virginia... Are there customers subsidize large customers in West Virginia?
I don't know that offhand. I know that we have been raising cross-subsidization concerns in the other direction.
I know you have. Is West Virginia, or is this applied in West Virginia in the PJM territory?
It is.
So if the PJM rate, roughly speaking, is probably in excess of 7 cents in Maryland, it probably is about the same in West Virginia. And yet, the West Virginia customer is receiving a 3 cent per kilowatt hour discount for some reason, which leads me to believe that there is some subsidization going on here.
It is. The difference, Mr. Chairman, is the difference between cost of service regulation, particularly on the fuel piece, where you have megawatt-weighted average price for fuel rather than all energy flowing through at the highest price of fuel. So this takes into account the latest fuel clause adjustment in West Virginia. This particular West Virginia utility uses its own generation to supply these customers. The rates reflect the cost of the use of that generation. The rates are not tied to market price. So I would respectfully disagree that there's any cross-subsidization going on, except perhaps in the other direction as a function of cost allocation and rate design.
So that's your complaints about PJM pricing, which is adding to the cost.
Correct. This is the difference between single clearing price, particularly on the energy component, where energy is priced in a lot of hours at a natural gas price rather than at a fuel-weighted average price. And the difference in West Virginia, you have a fuel-weighted average price going into the fuel clause.
On your testimony on page 2, you mentioned that the Ontario Independent Electricity System Operator, working with stakeholders, has recently taken significant steps to implement a more practical and rational approach to new resource procurement. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, the IESO recently identified and this was IESO working in conjunction with Ontario Power and a number of stakeholders, but identified the new resources it needed and the types of fuels that it desired, and it conducted an extensive RFP process for that new capacity and will be paying that new capacity the winning bid in that procurement process. It did not engage in a centralized capacity market like we have, say, with the forward capacity market in New England or the reliability pricing model in PJM.
Good. That's what I thought. Thank you. And thank you also for your very intricately described alternative design. That's something for us to discuss with our attorneys and our experts here to see whether we might get behind you with that at FERC. It's constructive to hear something like that. And thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your coming. Mr. Chairman, I believe you have a separate vote for 15 minutes.